Welcome back to The Cult Symbolism of Pop Culture. I'm your host, Isaac Wiseup. Today, we're in the Grey Lodge. It's the only place I want to be. It's in here with you. And we're going to look at Season 2, Episode 11, Masked Ball. We're going to continue. If you haven't, look, if you're new to Twin Peaks, you better catch up. Wait, what is this? How many episodes have we had? This is the 21st episode we've done. You got to catch up. Don't jump in right now. You're going to be really confused. And like I said on the last episode, this is where things are starting to heat up. A lot of people dismissed this part of season two. This is where the show gets so boring. Well, suck it up, Buttercup. This is where the intense stuff happens. I go back and forth. In the back of my mind, I do crazy stuff at night. I get anxiety, and I think about crazy stuff that'll never happen. I think about what I would do if I was on Joe Rogan's podcast, and it terrifies me. You know, I'm charting out what I'm going to tell Joe Rogan, as if he's ever going to invite me on his show. And the realization is I don't even want to do it. I don't want to be on his show. The guy's too smart. He's going to make me look like an idiot. It'll be the worst thing ever. I did another crazy thing I did. The other crazy thing I do is I have anxiety about people. When I get this book done, I'm doing my book tour, and I have anxiety about people asking me what's the best season of Twin Peaks, because I don't know. I don't know. There was a time where I would have said season one, then season three, then season two. There was a time when I would have said season one, season two, then season three. There's a time now where I say season two is the best, then three, then one. The truth is they're all great. And today we're looking at season two, episode 11. We're going to continue to reveal the meaning of the White Lodge. We heard about it last episode. We're going to learn more. We're going to find out there's a Black Lodge. And looking back in hindsight, on my whole Twin Peaks journey, I'm actually shocked that this is the first time it gets mentioned. It felt like it was mentioned in the first season, but it's not. This is when we start to get into it. That's why the second half of season two is invaluable. Cooper continues to show us he's on the path of the One, the Buddha, if you will. Ben Horn embraces Feng Shui. I'm going to drop a fun little Christmas vacation connection here. We're going to dive deep into the Black Lodge theories. The Dweller on the Threshold, Aleister Crowley, Corone Zone, Carl Jung's Shadow. We're going to hear from Mark Frost himself. Well, I'm going to read you from Mark Frost himself. He's going to tell us exactly where he got the ideas of the Black Lodge from. And what didn't you know it? Illuminate confirmed. It's from an occult book by Dion Fortune. She wrote the book Mystical Kabbalah. In this episode, curious name, Masked Ball, right? Because there ain't no Masked Ball in the episode. I'm gonna tell you what I think it means. And it's a concept that is very much in league with the occult, going back to the Hellfire Club, the Dashwood Caves, reminiscent of the Eyes Wide Shut orgy house at the Somerton Mansion. These events have ties into the occult world of Aleister Crowley and his Thelema religion. Where do you think he got that phrase, do what thou wilt? He got it in the Hellfire Caves at the Dashwood Menagerie, I guess. I don't know. And this episode here, it reveals a lot about what's going on in Twin Peaks. It explains to us the difference between White Lodge and Black Lodge, puts us right into the heart of the occult concepts of duality. Unbelievable. Let's start it out. We get the old 50s doo-woppy music. James is riding his hog. He's mean mugging. He actually does look cool. I got to give it up. James kind of looks cool right now. I have a theory about James. The more times you watch Twin Peaks, the more you realize James is kind of cool. The first time you watch it, you hate him. You're like, this guy sucks. He's got no emotion. He's just a bozo. He's got a big forehead. Why are these chicks all over this guy? He has no personality. But the more you watch it, the more you warm up to James, and you're kind of like, you know what? He's all right. And for me, well, we're going to talk about in Fire Walk With Me. There's a scene in Fire Walk With Me that, I don't know, he looks kind of cool. Okay, so James, he's riding his hog. You remember he's leaving Twin Peaks. He found out Maddie died a couple episodes ago, and he's like, I'm out of here. He's had enough. Laura got killed. Now Maddie got killed. It's a dark place, and he's out. Meanwhile, Major Briggs, he's missing, remember? He was night fishing with Cooper. Last we saw him, white flash of light, owls, boom, he's gone. So his wife, Betty, she's at the sheriff's office. She's pretty blasé about the whole thing, honestly. She's like, yeah, he's gone missing before. Old hat for her. She asked Cooper if this is work-related or what. And Cooper's like, no, we were out in the woods. I took a leak and bam, he was gone. Betty tells them that Briggs is talking about the woods all the time. And Cooper asks directly, he says, look, was he out in the woods trying to make contact with forces or entities out there? And she stone cold looks at him and says, that's classified, which tells me that, yes, that's what they're doing out there. Next, Cooper, he's in trouble. He's being interrogated by the FBI for charges with the One-Eyed Jacks thing, the Audrey Horn rescue mission. The FBI are there interrogating him. Take a look at this. They got a laptop, a Macintosh laptop from 1990. That thing must have costed $1 bazillion, and it's relatively small. It's probably just a word processor or something. I don't know if it's a laptop. Did they even have laptops back then? But Cooper says, he says, look, I'm going to own up where I broke the FBI code, and I'm going to defend myself. Agent Roger, he is like, they're kind of doing a little standoff, right? And it's interesting because Cooper goes into this interesting talk about how he sort of had this awakening into bigger issues. And how he's focusing beyond the edge of the board to a bigger game. And, of course, he's probably referring to a chessboard, which is very Freemasonic. And it also embodies the concepts of duality with the tessellating black and white squares like you find on the floor of the Freemason lodges. Anyway, I'm going to play the clip. The transformation of Cooper is happening before our eyes. Take a listen.
Agent Cooper. It's showtime. You've heard the charges. What do you wish to present as your defense?
I have no defense. I am completely confident in the rightness of my actions. Some of it occurred outside of Bureau guidelines, and I will pay the price for that. But I am innocent of any criminal wrongdoing. If they wish to charge me, I will defend myself in a court of law.
There's a right way and a wrong way to do this. And the first thing we expect is a Bureau man to stand up for himself. Now, a man who can't, who doesn't even try, well, he may be packing feathers where his spine is supposed to be.
Roger, I know the moves I'm supposed to make. And I know the board.
So?
I've been doing a lot of thinking lately. And I've started to focus out beyond the edge of the board. At a bigger game.
What game?
The sound wind makes through the pines. The sentience of animals. What we fear in the dark and what lies beyond the darkness.
What the hell are you talking about?
I'm talking about seeing beyond fear, Roger. About looking at the world with love.
They're liable to extradite you for murder and drug trafficking.
These are things I cannot control.
Cooper is on the path, man. He says He's focusing beyond the edge of the board to a bigger game. What's the bigger game? I believe it's his role in his true will. He says the sound wind makes through the pines. You see that constantly in the show. They show you the pine trees swaying in the breeze. The sentience of animals. And what lies beyond the darkness? And he's talking about seeing beyond fear and looking at the world with love. Because you remember what Briggs was talking about and Hawk, that the fate of Cooper, the role, the true will for Cooper is that he is a man who can face the darkness and the evil and not have fear in his heart and remain with love. And this is very important. Are we preparing to confront Coron's own, one's own shadow? Is this Tibetan Buddhism philosophy implying he's continuing on his path of the one to break from the samsara, the wheel, the reincarnation wheel? He has the fate of facing darkness like Briggs told him in the woods before he got away, and Cooper has a certain confidence in the scene. It's very palpable. Even when Roger warns him, he tries to pull him back into the samsara, into the social construct, into the matrix. He says, Cooper, quit acting like a tough guy. You're going to get extradited for murder charges. It's murder. And Cooper, he just calmly says, these are things I cannot control. The enlightened one. He's Neo in the Matrix. He sees the code. He sees what the Buddhists called the Maya, the illusory nature of the world. And he has no fear. He knows his fate. He's not worried at all. He is the Buddha opening his mind to the samsara reality, the repeating loop of karma we see symbolized by all the donuts and the circular motion and the circles in the show. This is why he kept talking about Tibet. He's breaking free from the repeating cycle. He is becoming enlightened, like the Buddha, with love. At this point, he will become the ascended master who can enlighten others to break free from samsara. But I don't want to get ahead of myself. That's what I think is happening in the show. Nadine, she's in high school, and she's expressing interest in Mike. You remember Mike, a.k.a. Snake? And she hits up Donna at the locker room. And she asked Donna, she says, do you mind if I make my move on Mike? Because remember, Donna was dating him forever ago. And who can blame Nadine? Have you seen Mike's buns? Look at those buns. Meanwhile, James, he's still on the road. He heads to Wally's hideout bar in some other town. It looks identical to Twin Peaks. It's a logging town. Looks the same. He gets approached by a blonde seductress named Evelyn. She's wearing a red dress coat of sorts with very visible thigh-high stockings. She asks James if he can fix cars because her husband's Jaguar needs some body work. James has a look like he knows he's about to sleep with this woman. James gets all the ladies. And it's interesting she's wearing red. It's the symbolism of the harlot. The Whore of Babylon ushering in the end times, the end of the world. Is that what we're looking at? Time will tell. Meanwhile, Dick Tremaine back. You know, I'm not a fan of this subplot. The Dick Tremaine, Andy, Lucy love triangle. But Dick shows up. He's got this orphan boy now because he's trying to show that he can take care of kids. And the boy's name is Little Nicky. And they're using Little Nicky as a pawn to prove who's the better father to Lucy. And it should be noted that Adam Sandler later came out with a movie called Little Nicky about the devil. From what I read online, the two aren't necessarily connected, although Adam Sandler has in fact worked with Mrs. Tremond. What's her name? Anyways, he worked with a couple of the characters that were also in Twin Peaks, so there's theories that he was influenced by this Little Nicky. Not a huge role as far as I can see in Twin Peaks. So moving on. Back to Cooper. Cooper asked Truman, he says, hey, have you heard of the thing called the White Lodge? Because Briggs was trying to tell me about a White Lodge and he disappeared. And then Hawk chimes up. You know, Hawk's the Native American. He knows the land. He knows what's up. He says there's a local legend about other worlds. And the White Lodge is where the spirits that rule man and nature reside. And this goes back hundreds of years to the Nez Perce tribe, which you find out in the book. But what's more interesting is that he says, but you should know there's also a Black Lodge. That's the shadow of the White Lodge. And every spirit must pass through there on their way to perfection, where you meet the shadow self. And the way I understand it in terms of the occult or Buddhism even, to become an ascended master of theosophy, you have to achieve perfection. And to do this, you have to break the cycles of reincarnation. And according to some of these occultists, who in fact went to Tibet and studied Buddhism, they claim that you have to confront your own shadow to do this. But apparently, if you're not ready, and they call the shadow self the dweller on the threshold in the show. If you're not ready, if you approach the Black Lodge and the shadow with imperfect courage, your soul gets annihilated. No big deal. You're gone, though, right? No more redos, no more extra lives. It's a wrap, son. So take a listen, because this is very important, again, to the concept of Twin Peaks. Take a listen.
Well, Harry, the giant said a path is formed by laying one stone at a time. Have either of you fellows heard of a place called the White Lodge?
Where'd you hear of it?
Well, it was the last thing Major Briggs said to me before he disappeared.
Cooper, you may be fearless in this world, but there are other worlds.
Tell me more.
My people believe that the White Lodge is a place where the spirits that rule man and nature here reside.
The local legend goes way back.
There is also a legend of a place called the Black Lodge, the shadow self of the White Lodge. The legend says that every spirit must pass through there on the way to perfection. There, you will meet your own shadow self. My people call it the Dweller on the Threshold.
The Dweller on the Threshold.
But it is said, if you confront the Black Lodge with imperfect courage, it will utterly annihilate your soul.
This could be the most occult thing on the entire show, and it was just revealed, hidden in plain sight. And again, you're going to read more about this idea going all the way back to Lewis and Clark when they found the Nez Perce tribe of the Twin Peaks area in the Secret History of Twin Peaks book. For now, though, let's focus on the occult concept at play here. Officially, we've now heard about a White Lodge in the last episode. Now we hear about the Black Lodge in this episode from Hawk. Both are places where spirits that rule man and nature reside. And the Black Lodge is the shadow of the White Lodge. And that everyone has to pass through the Black Lodge, confront their shadow self, the dweller on the threshold, as Hawk refers to it. And if you approach the Black Lodge, the shadow self, without being prepared, your soul gets annihilated. And there's a theme of opposing polarities here. You've got the positive and the negative. Both things complement each other and constitute the whole of existence. You can't have one without the other. That's what the occult themes are over and over and over. In Twin Peaks, you hear a lot about opposing polarities of love and fear. You'll also see in Twin Peaks the principle of electricity, which is based upon positive and negative polarities. But yeah, it's believed that the two lodges embody the two forces. The White Lodge is love, the Black Lodge is fear. In the last episode, Major Briggs tries to unofficially initiate Cooper when he talks to him about these powerful forces of evil and about how it's some men's fate to face the great darkness that is the Black Lodge that we only find out now. And of course, some men, I think he's referring to Cooper. He tells Cooper, if we choose fear, we become vulnerable to the darkness. But Cooper is blessed with certain gifts to resist that fear. He believes, I think, that Cooper can approach the Black Lodge with love in his heart. Therefore, his soul will not be annihilated. He is the anomaly. He is going to confront his shadow self in the Black Lodge and become perfected. In Helena Blavatsky's Theosophy, we're referring to the Ascended Masters. We also hear about the shadow self at this point. We got to understand that. Let's deep dive into the shadow because it's very important in the whole whole Twin Peaks, especially season 3. And I went deeper into this topic in my book, The Dark Path, because I believe it's part of understanding how symbolism works. Carl Jung was a proponent of this theory of a shadow. He had a dream of a large black figure chasing him through a fog, and he had a small light in his hands, and he determined that the cause of this shadow was from the light in his own hands. It was from himself. The black figure was actually him being chased by his own shadow. And it's believed that our true inner self is the actual shadow. And we are conditioned by society to project a persona. That is basically a filtered out version of our true self. We suppress the darker natures of ourselves to stay in the tribe, kind of, right? There's an individuation process where you can understand yourself, the shadow self, and incorporate that into the persona. A metaphor used to understand this process, Alan Watts compared the shadow to the manure used as fertilizer to grow a rose. You need both. And initiates, they in secret societies, they'll be forced to face their shadow when they are taken into the darkness to confront their own death, like we saw Catherine go through in the last episode. An initiated person can reconcile these opposing forces within them of light and dark, the White Lodge and the Black Lodge, and employ certain aspects of their shadow self. We've seen this concept in the Star Wars story where the initiate must balance the force. That's Luke Skywalker's mission, to balance the force. The force, of course, is light and dark. There's a light and a dark side to the force. And you'll notice in the show, in Star Wars, they don't try to obliterate the dark side. They try to balance the two. The two are needed. You have to balance the opposing polarities. Dr. Stephen Flowers wrote about this concept in a book called Lords of the Left-Hand Path in a section on the Brotherhood of Saturn. And he says that darkness precedes light, and without it, you could not even have light. The darkness provides the opportunity for light to exist. One must embrace both sides of the light and the dark. Good versus evil, Black Lodge, White Lodge, you get it, right? And Carl Jung advocated that doing inner exploration to understand your shadow allows one to embrace their opposing sides that exist within us. Friedrich Nietzsche, philosopher, advocated the same thing. He called it the transvaluation of values and advocated to indulge in quote-unquote sinful activities. And it should be noted, Jung and Nietzsche both had confrontations with their unconscious shadow and both had nervous breakdowns, right? They weren't ready to cross the abyss and face Caron's own. Aleister Crowley talked about this concept as well with occult magic from the perspective of becoming what he called the master of the temple. It's the most important operation a magician can perform. And the operation is what they refer to as gazing into the abyss, confronting the demons that guard the abyss. The guardian demon is called Caron's own. And I believe that John Dee even talked about Caron's own back in the Middle Ages. And Caron's own guards the hidden realm on the Kabbalistic tree of life known as Deoth. That's where you get the Deoth Vader, Darth Vader. But the initiate is trained to ascend the Kabbalistic tree of life towards the topmost Sephirot, which is called the Kether. That's where one becomes God. And don't look, if your eyes are glazing over, stick with me. I'm almost done. I'm going to lay this out then we'll revisit these ideas as we explore Twin Peaks. But Day-Oth is a shortcut, right? But to go through the shortcut, you got to face Caron's Own in the Abyss. Now, this should all sound very familiar to what we hear about in Twin Peaks, with the initiate approaching their shadow in the Black Lodge and the dweller on the threshold, as Hawk puts it. In fact, let's put a bow on this. Let's take a look at Aleister Crowley's book, Confessions. He says, and I quote, "The name of the dweller in the abyss is Caron's Own. Dweller on the threshold, dweller in the abyss." See? Same thing, same concept. Crowley called it the dweller in the abyss, just like Hawk describes it as the dweller on the threshold. Crowley seems to describe the Black Lodge as well. I'm going to read you the rest of that quote. "The name of the dweller in the abyss is Caron's Own, but he is not really an individual. The abyss is empty of being. It is filled with all possible forms, each equally inane, each therefore evil in the only true sense of the word, that is meaningless but malignant, insofar as it craves to become real. These forms swirl senselessly into haphazard heaps like dust devils, and each such chance aggregation asserts itself to be an individual and shrieks, 'I am I,' though aware all the time that its elements have no true bond, so that the slightest disturbance dissipates the delusion, just as a horseman, meeting a dust devil, brings it in showers of sand to the earth." Now, don't ask me what all that means, because I certainly don't know. But Crowley seems to be describing the Black Lodge. Spirits craving to be real is what he talked about in the Abyss. What does that sound like? This sounds like Bob. The spirits that inhabit the owls, they want to incarnate as human beings. And Bob was able to do that through Leland. It should be noted, Crowley also wrote a novel called Moonchild, and in it, there's a Black Lodge of magicians trying to create an Antichrist. Before we move on, in the context of this story, you know, Mark Frost wrote the whole Twin Peaks story, and it's claimed that he got the idea of the Black Lodge from a Dion Fortune book, which tells me he's very much read into the occult concepts, because Dion Fortune isn't light reading that normal people would get into. She actually wrote Mystical Kabbalah, which I attempted to read. It's very difficult. But in a 1992 interview with The Independent, he confirms it, this is what the article says. "As the series grew wilder and woolier, it became clear that someone behind the cameras had been nosing around in some pretty strange areas. It wasn't just the business about Project Blue Book and its UFO research, or Native American legends, or the free-floating thing of evil known only as Bob. There were also references to obscure folklore concerning Stonehenge, and most curious of all, to Black Lodges. This last term seemed as if it must have been lifted from a book you don't expect to find next to bound copies of Variety on a producer's shelves. The minor occult classic, Psychic Self-Defense by Dion Fortune." Quote, "That's right, that's exactly where I got the Black Lodge from," agrees Mark Frost, who not only wrote most of Twin Peaks, but co-produced it with David Lynch, directed some episodes, and even, reverse nepotism, I guess you'd call it, cast his father, a professional actor, in the role of Dr. Haywood. "The whole mythological side of Twin Peaks was really down to me, and I've always known about the Theosophical writers and that whole group around the Order of the Golden Dawn in the late 19th and early 20th century. W.B. Yeats, Madame Blavatsky, and a woman named Alice Bailey, a very interesting writer. Talk like this has a refreshingly otherworldly sound in the context of an upstairs room at the Groucho Club in Soho, and theosophy isn't the only hermetic topic Frost brings up. In the course of an hour or so discussing his past, present, and future activities, Frost also has occasion to mention the voodoo-related cult of Santeria, ley lines, spiritualism, and the work of the popular English occultist Colin Wilson." Ugh. Now, Mark Frost was the director of The Believers, a show Martin Sheen was in. That was very occult. I think it was Santeria's on that, where they were trying to do child sacrifices. Now, in that same interview, Frost talks about his interest in mysticism. He says, whatever the sources of Conan Doyle's fiction, Frost's only early writings were prompted by folklore. As a boy, I found myself drawn to Arthurian legends and then to Celtic mythology and then further east into the mysticism of Asian religions, hence Agent Cooper's otherwise baffling interest in Tibet. Now, it's fascinating to me because when I was a boy, I also was intrigued by King Arthur. I remember very clearly reading about King Arthur in some book, I don't know where. I remember it for a fact, and I couldn't tell you a thing about King Arthur, but I know it appears often in research of the occult. It's one of those topics I need to get back into. But I think it's interesting how some people are drawn into this stuff like I am. Okay, I lied. I said we were moving on. We're not moving on. Let's look at the Dion Fortune book real quick. Real quick. In that book, Psychic, what the hell is it called? Psychic Self-Defense. I got a copy of this thing. She talks about the perils of joining a lodge that isn't quite black, yet how it can easily go black with corruption. A gray lodge, if you will. And the book's title tells us it's about psychic attack. So she, you know, she lays out a foundation. And to me, it sounds very Twin Peaks-esque. I'm going to read you from her book. We live in the midst of invisible forces whose effects alone we perceive. We move among invisible forms whose actions we very often do not perceive at all, though we may be profoundly affected by them. In the mind side of nature, invisible to our senses, intangible to our instruments of precision, many things can happen that are not without their echo on the physical plane. There are beings that live in this invisible world as fish live in the sea. There are men and women with trained minds or special aptitudes who can enter into this invisible world as a diver descends to the ocean bed. There are also times when, as happens to land when the sea dikes break, the invisible forces flow in upon us and swamp our lives. Now, the Black Lodge, further in, there's a chapter that talks about various occult organizations one could find themselves in, including the Black Lodge. This is what it says. The really black lodges are as carefully guarded as the high-grade white lodges, and no outsider can gain entrance to them. The serious student of black occultism is out for knowledge and magical experiment, and he is not going to waste his time on a tyro. Those who choose to graduate into a black lodge after serving their apprenticeship into the outer court of a white lodge do so with their eyes open, and experience must be their teacher. And she's talking about, when she says a tyro, that's like a newbie. Like, you got to know what you're doing with this occult stuff before they'll let you in the Black Lodge. And we're going to come back to this idea pretty soon in a couple episodes here when we learn more about Wyndham Earle's intentions in this story. Let's get back into Twin Peaks. That was the heavy-duty stuff, though. This is the point where we get introduced to Dennis Bryson from the DEA. It's David Duchovny, and he's wearing, I would say drag. I don't know if that's the right term anymore. He's dressed up as a woman, and he says, look, I'd rather you call me Denise. And Denise says, look, Cooper's being accused of stealing drugs to use in this operation. Cooper tells her, look, I'm being set up. And it's ironic that Duchovny would appear in Twin Peaks prior to X-Files because they have very similar storylines. In fact, there was recently a comic book, I think it was an X-Files comic book, that confirmed that the two worlds are connected. I'm not certain that that's official canon, but it's there. Meanwhile, Josie, she shows up at Truman's place, remember, to tell him about how she was once, when she was a child, she was saved by this man named Andrew Packard. Because she was a I don't know if a slave is the right word for this guy, Thomas Eckard. And Eckard's business associate was Packard, and Packard saved her. And she says that Eckard had Packard killed at some point. And then Eckard sent this goon That's the goon you saw several episodes ago taking Josie away from Twin Peaks and back to Hong Kong. Meanwhile, James, he's fixing up Evelyn Marsh's car. She offers James a place to stay since her husband is out of town for work. It's clear where this is heading. Okay. Meanwhile, Ben, he's at the Great Northern. He's watching these old reel-to-reel tapes of a groundbreaking ceremony of the Great Northern Hotel when he was a child. And you'll notice they appear to use a golden shovel for the groundbreaking ceremony. It's black and white footage, but you know, it's shiny. It's giving heavy National Lampoon Christmas Vacation vibes. Remember that? Clark is stuck up in the attic and he watches old reel-to-reel tapes of himself as a kid. He's having a moment. Same thing that Ben Horn is going through. Exactly. Smiling, kind of crying, kind of laughing. And it's interesting because the composer to all the Twin Peaks music we know and love, Angelo Badalamenti, rest in peace, he actually did the music for Christmas Vacation before Twin Peaks. So, weird connection there. Meanwhile, Hank walks in and he's talking trash to Ben. Remember, he worked for Ben just a minute ago and now he's talking trash because Ben's losing everything. Remember Catherine, she finagled all these plans out from under him. He's kind of not doing so hot. And Hank's like, look, I'm taking over One-Eyed Jack's. Ben, you know, he's laying out all these grievances about how his life's been falling apart. Hank don't care though. He's a cold-blooded killer. And Ben talks about how he's going to rearrange the furniture in his office to build a certain resonance through a perfect alignment of places and how this is going to benefit the individual staying in that place. And this is a lot like the ideas of Feng Shui, a Chinese concept about mankind tuning into his environment, being connected and finding optimal arrangements of furniture in a living space. There can be a perfect balance of harmony and energy that can be found. Ben seems to be striving for this. He's hit rock bottom at this point, which is kind of sad in a way because you remember those first few episodes of Twin Peaks in season one? He was so full of life. He was a creep, but he was happy. Him and his creepy brother Jerry were sneaking off to One-Eyed Jack's. They were having a great time. Now he's just isolating in his hotel, down on his luck. It's kind of sad seeing him like this, but Hank's in there to tell him, like, look, I'm not taking orders from you anymore, dude. I work for Jean Renault. And this appears to be the final straw for Ben. You know, he's losing another business venture of his. This time he's losing One-Eyed Jack's, which is, I'm going to argue, his favorite one. But before we move on, notice that video footage, that reel-to-reel footage of him as a child, a golden shovel. This is going to show up in season three. Not really a plot spoiler, just an observance. Not sure how it connects, but we're going to see a little bit of that in season three. Meanwhile, Cooper, he opens up an envelope addressed to him from Wyndham Earl. Man, this guy, it's another chess move. Back in episode 6 of season 2, he had a chess move. It's been a while. And this time it includes a cassette tape where Earl, he's threatening Cooper. And he says, the king must die. This reminds me of our talk in the early episodes. We talked about the theories of James Shelby Downard. And he wrote the King Kill Ritual. About JFK being murdered as a ritual. The king must die. Meanwhile, Dougie, we're almost done. Dougie is getting married again, right? His brother, the mayor, he objects, calls out his lady as a gold digger, says that, look, she's just trying to take your publishing empire because he owns the Twin Peaks Gazette, remember? Then, you know, at the wedding there, Denise tells Cooper he found, or she found cocaine in his car. And she does believe that he's being framed. She also has the bouquet from the Milford wedding ceremony and comments how it seemed unfair how many of the bridesmaids were varsity wide receivers. I don't really get that. Cooper asks about Denise's transition. I don't know why I had that in my notes. Cooper asks about Denise's transition, and she says that during one of the FBI operations, she was required to wear women's clothes, and she was surprised at how much it relaxed her. She almost pursuing her true will, right? And the storyline is very revolutionary in terms of normalizing transgender people in entertainment. Everyone on the show treats Denise with respect, the proper pronouns. She's not this sort of comical character. You know, back in the day, the transgender people, or they call her transsexual in the back in the 90s. But the trans people, they were depicted as weirdos and creeps. And remember Ace Ventura kisses Lieutenant Einhorn? And they make a shtick about their crying game, and, you know, he's all disgusted. It's a big joke, right? So it was way ahead of its time by depicting a trans character with respect, which is pretty cool, you know? But Lynch is a pretty cool guy. So we see Cooper at the wedding. He's dancing with Audrey. Heartbreaking. Heartbreaking. We want to see Cooper hook up with her, but it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Meanwhile, Catherine, she confronts Josie, coerces her to be her slave under the threat that Catherine will find Eckhart and let him know where his precious Josie is hiding at. And then the episode ends with a plot twist. When we find out Andrew Packard is actually alive and he's working with Catherine, who is his sister, to try and lure Eckhart back to Twin Peaks, regardless, to find Josie. Now, why was this episode, and that's the end of the episode. Lots of questions left here, right? For me, a big question is, why did they call this the Masked Ball? Some believe it's referring to the Milford wedding, but no one's wearing a mask. It's not a ball. So that seems a bit off mark. I believe the title was referring to the concept of the shadow because Carl Jung described the outward persona as the mask that you show everyone. It hides the shadow. And sticking to that Dashwood Hellfire Cave occult idea, they would have masked balls in these caves. They would have orgies, these, you know, politicians and local celebrities and the town, you know, whatever, would show up and they would put masks on so they could participate in doing all their nasty little deeds. The mask was meant to suppress the ego and let the reptilian sort of shadow come out to play. You can see their true desires and motivations. So that's season 2, episode 10. Or 11, sorry. Your homework. You're going to watch Season 2, episode 12, The Black Widow. And come right back here. We're going to keep diving deep. Things are accelerating here, folks. It may not seem that way, but they are. Thanks for your support. Thanks for listening. Stay woke.